This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, filling in for Neil Conan. No one ever said raising a teenager is easy, but today's teenagers face a range of temptations that were unheard of not so long ago, and some kids seem ready to experiment with everything from drugs to sexual promiscuity to suicidal behavior. Parents who feel they've tried everything sometimes turn to special therapeutic schools geared to deal with the problems of today's troubled teens. Removed from the temptations of their communities, schools, and friends, the programs are aimed at helping kids change from the inside out. Sometimes the programs work, sometimes they don't. In just a moment, we'll talk to author David Marcus, who spent more than a year at one facility in rural Massachusetts called Swift River. And later in the program, a look at Kobe, Japan, 10 years after its devastating earthquake. But first, teens in trouble. We want to hear from parents who have struggled to discipline sons or daughters with dangerous habits. Or if you've ever attended a program for troubled teens, give us a call and tell us whether it helped or not. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is David Marcus, who wrote a book about Swiftwater, the therapeutic program he visited. The book is What It Takes to Pull Me Through, Why Teenagers Get in Trouble, and How Four of Them Got Out. David Marcus is with us from a studio at member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
First of all, Swiftwater is a therapeutic boarding school. What is that exactly?
Well, if you'd asked me that 4.5 years ago, I would have said I had no idea. I was working for U.S. News and World Report, and my editor asked me to look into all these schools that are popping up around the country, especially in rural areas, and also across around the world, too. And basically, kids are sent away when parents are desperate. They feel like they have no other choice. The kids are really acting out at home. And they are sent away for usually more than a year. In the case of Swift River, the Academy of Swift River, it's 14 months. And they get intensive therapy there. I was with the kids for this book. I was with them. I started doing a magazine story, and I got so intrigued I went back to write a book about it. I went to group therapy with them 3 times a week. That's usually 2.5 hours a time. They do some exercise, although it's not heavy exercise. They wake up at 6 in the morning, and they have to clean their rooms, and they start with a full load of academics. Every day they have that, and then afterwards they have sports in the afternoon or other activities. At night they have a night meeting. They sort of talk about what they've been thinking about that night. They read aloud essays they've been doing. They write letters to their parents, and they talk to their parents on the phone, and the parents come up for workshops. Now, I want to say that it was a fascinating, fascinating experience, and I think you're exactly right, that sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't.
And you mentioned that in this particular program, there's a lot of parental involvement, or the parents have to be involved in this program, where some programs are not. Is that right?
Right. And I had this misconception. It was just sort of parents kind of outsourcing their nettlesome, their irksome children, just the way they outsourced crabgrass in their lawn. They got an expert to come in and take care of it. They drew their shades and they forgot about it. This particular program, the parents have to come up every 3 months, a little bit more than that, for workshops and for long weekends and for discussions with their kids, for family therapy, which is sort of, you know, just let it all hang out kind of family therapy. They talk about their own drinking, sometimes the parents, their own abuse of prescription drugs, their own depression, their own problems in their marriages. It's pretty intense. And so, yes, the parents have to be involved. And I would say that's key, too, because, you know, there's a saying, I'll put it politely, but behind every messed up teenager, there's a messed up parent.
I was about to say, to what degree are the parents responsible for the situation the family finds itself in?
Well, a lot of times the parents are responsible in some ways. For instance, if there's discord or problems in the marriage, you know, who suffers? The kids suffer. If a parent's suffering depression, is parents depressed and not doing anything about it? A lot of times the kids will feel the pain of it. Now, I will say that, and this is something that people can debate for years and years, but there is evidence that there are some kids who genetically just have they have a chemical imbalance. They have they have mood disorders. They're bipolar, things like that. It's not as simple as blaming the parents for every little thing. I went there thinking, well, these parents were lax. They didn't have boundaries. They didn't have rules. The kids were spoiled brats. They're rich, uppity kids. And I was amazed to find some amazingly sweet, smart, incredibly talented kids when I went there and just hung out with them. First, my story for the magazine, and then for more than a year for a book. And I have to say that sometimes the parents were befuddled. They just didn't know what had happened. The kids had kind of gotten in with the wrong crowd, and they had, or as I said, they just had a mood disorder that was chemical, and it wasn't, you know, related to parents' actions or inactions or how many times mom baked apple pie or dad stayed at home and worked at home. But I would say in the majority of cases, the parents certainly had a lot to do with a family dysfunction had a lot to do with a dysfunctional kid.
Well, sitting with me in Studio 3A is someone I think we should bring into the conversation now, and that's a young man named Ben. He's asked us not to use his last name, and he was a student at Swiftwater. He's 18 years old, and thanks for being with us, Ben.
Thank you.
And he's also featured, I should say, in your book under another name.
Right. I mean, I'll just say he was... He's an amazing kid who just surprised me all the time with his insights into things. And in the book, I call him Phil the Philosopher because the book is true and the incidents are true, but because they're minors and because they're families who were very generous with me with their time and their pain, I changed the name. So I call him Phil the Philosopher. Hey, Ben.
What's up?
Ben, tell us what brought you to Swiftwater.
I was just a really angry and lonely kid who didn't really know how to handle my stuff, and I started doing lots and lots of drugs. And basically my parents said, Bennett, you screw up, you're getting sent to a therapeutic treatment center. I screwed up, got suspended for smoking weed, got sent.
When did you start doing drugs?
When I was 14, I was a freshman in high school.
Now, when you said you were kind of lonely, and did this start happening as you became a teenager? I mean, did you go through a real big transformation from, I don't know, say the age of 10 or 11 till 14 when you started really getting into drugs?
I would say it really started like in the 7th grade, so I guess I was 11 or 12. And that's just, I mean, all these things happened to me in my life, and I really started acting out and feeling it and just acting negatively right around that age.
Yeah. And did Swiftwater help you to sort of sort out what those things were and deal with them?
Yeah, it really did. It really did.
In what way? How did it do that?
Well, I mean, just the combination of therapy and not really therapy, but just talking and realizing what happened to you in your life, because I lived in denial. I mean, I forgot. I mean, when I was in the 2nd grade, I was hit by my 2nd grade teacher. And for years, I just completely forgot about it, and I just wasn't something I thought about. And Swift River really helped me, like, bring that to the fore and just relive the experiences and feel what it felt like and then dealing with it.
And Swift River begins with an outdoor experience.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty formative part of that experience. Maybe you could explain what happens there.
Basically, I hated the outdoor part. It's one of the toughest things I've ever done in my life. And if forced to do it again, I would just walk away.
Is it like an Outward Bound kind of program? Or
it was... like Outward Bound meets military camp.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we woke up, it was very strict, very regimented, you know, just, it was kind of hard to describe the experience, but other than just...
Well, Lynn, can I jump in since
yeah, sure.
I knew him when he first arrived? He, mm-hmm. I mean, I love these kids. They're just great, great kids. And he made me laugh the first time I met him, but he was sullen and angry and he did not want to be there. I remember him in the woods. I think he's great at doing outdoor stuff. He thrives at that. But what he didn't like, frankly, I think what Ben didn't like was having to sit down and write letters to his parents, having to write journals about what happened to him, about what went wrong, and face it. And Ben, you know, not everybody listening knows you. I mean, I got to know you pretty well. And his story is, look, he's emblematic in some ways. I was a teenager I did some drinking and some stuff that people shouldn't do at 17 and 18 with my friends. But my friends and I did it quickly. We got it over with. I mean, you know, Ben, you can talk about it, but you went from pot to heroin at age, you know, before you were 15 in the matter of a few weeks, right?
Yeah,
who introduced you to heroin?
Just one of my friends. I gave him money to get me some drugs one weekend. He came back with heroin, and I was like, gotta do what you gotta do. You know, plopped it on the table, put it in my nose.
And your parents found out about that, and that was that what led to...
No, my parents had no clue. I mean, my parents knew that I was doing drugs, but they didn't know the extent. They found out when I was at Swift River that I was doing heroin.
Wow. So they didn't even know you had gotten to that point yet.
No.
What were you doing then that sort of finally had them say?
Well, I got suspended for smoking resin, which is the residue of weed.
Mm-hmm.
And what was I doing? I was basically doing anything under the sun. If it was a drug and I could get my hands on it, it was in my body.
What about now?
Now, it's hard. I'm trying to be sober. I had a relapse a couple months ago, and that was really messed up, and it was really scary for me. But right now, I'm just walking the straight and narrow.
So did Swiftwater give you the tools to sort of help yourself when you had that relapse also?
It really did. It really did.
All right. We're going to take a call now. Let's go to Anne from Long Island. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to comment on my own experience as a youth. When I was about 13, I needed to be treated for severe depression, and at that time, I was also experimenting with alcohol and drugs, but it was in the residential center that I actually, it was a youth residential center where I became exposed to even more dangerous drugs. And not only that, I went there as it was a residential program and it's a day program, but after I left there, my school refused to accept me back as a regular ed student, and at that time, I had to go into an alternative learning center. Learning center, and it really impacted greatly upon my life. I mean, as just far as an educational experience, I was ill-prepared. I eventually did go on to college, but I didn't have the educational skills that I needed. And also as the residential treatment center, it exposed me to, you know, even worse drugs that I was doing at the time. Like, at the time I was 13, I'd experimented with alcohol and perhaps marijuana, but while I was there, I was exposed to PCP, LSD, and I mean,
so you're saying the center that you went to for help actually made things worse?
Absolutely. And, I mean, you know, it was in an affluent part of Long Island. It wasn't as if it was, you know, it was lacking in funds. It just exposed me to a greater element. I mean, people that were in there were, obviously, they all had their problems. They were like, and it was, you know, they did have a 12-step program in there as well that was offered to the teens. But it impacted on my life in two ways. It exposed me to more drugs, but not only that, it impacted on my education.
All right, Ann.
Lynn, can I mention something about that?
Yes, Ann, thanks so much for your call. And
thank you.
We are going to have to take a break shortly, so if you could respond really quickly, and then we'll take up some of the issues that Ann raised when we come back.
Okay, sure. This is David. I think the important thing is that a place like Swift River, while it does have problems, it isolates the kids. It's very hard to get drugs in there. It's very hard to get even cigarettes in there. It's way in the western part of Massachusetts, and that's an important thing. If you just sort of throw all these kids together with eating disorders and drug problems and so forth in a place where they can get stuff, that can be real trouble.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion when we return. It's Talk the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. We're talking about families with teens who have struggled with drug and alcohol abuse, promiscuity, and other problematic behaviors. Our guests are David Marcus. He's the author of the book, What It Takes to Pull Me Through, which focuses on four teens who attended a therapeutic program in Massachusetts called Swift River. He also is a contributing editor to the magazine U.S. News and World Report. He joins us from member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts. We're also joined by Ben, an 18-year-old who graduated from Swift River in 2002. You're invited to join the discussion if you're a teenager who has engaged in any risky behaviors or used to and would like to discuss that with us. Give us a call. We also want to hear from parents. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Let's go back to you David. And I have to apologize. I know a couple of times I've said Swift Water, and I can't explain why. I know it's Swift River is the name of the school, and I've just slipped a couple of times.
Believe me, parents do it all the time, too, because there are schools with similar names. But I just want to clarify it because, people get confused, but it's Swift River, right?
Right. And now, in your book, you focused on one particular group of kids that went through the program at Swift River and on four of the people within that program particularly. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
About sure. I'll tell you, it was like, you know, they say it's sort of like the old cliche about choosing among your children who's the favorite one. Like, you know, the guy I call Phil, the philosopher, Ben, who's in your studio, he was so smart and so interesting. I could have written a whole book about him, probably a trilogy. But before I did the book, I spent a year talking to psychologists, guidance counselors, and others, and I sort of came up with four archetypes, if you will, sort of four kinds of kids I wanted to find, and I did in that group. And so one was a kid who had lost a parent. The parent had died. And I have a girl named Bianca from Florida. She fits that. And she's a middle-class kid. And then I had a kid who has ADD, attention deficit disorder, and just could not sit still in a regular classroom and was very impulsive, couldn't control his impulses sometimes. And I have a kid named DJ who's from the suburbs of New Jersey who fits that. And then I wanted a kid who went through a really wrenching divorce of his parents And I have a kid named Tyrone, an African-American kid from a tough neighborhood in Queens, New York, who's that. And finally, I wanted somebody who just seemed to have it all. You drive by this house with a three-car garage and the beautiful SUVs in the parking lot and in the driveway and the pool in the backyard and the jacuzzi and all that. And I found a girl named Mary Alice who was from a very, very affluent neighborhood who she says it herself, this beautiful blonde family, perfect. You think they had everything. They had three houses and so on and so forth. And so I wanted to sort of see what happened to those kids. What was that mystery? And in a lot of ways, it was like writing a thriller because stuff had happened. Even their parents had no idea, as Ben just told you. And they're not bad parents at all. These parents really were trying, but they were dealing with their own issues and in some cases a really tough divorce or financial setbacks. And I just want to see what had happened to them, what went wrong. And in a larger way, because most of America's 29 million teenagers are doing just great. They're thriving. I want to see why is it that there's some out there, a subgroup out there from all races and all incomes who are struggling.
Ben, do you have any insight into that after having gone through Swift River and spent that time with those kids?
Everybody has pain. Everybody has hurt. And it's just how you deal with that pain. And do you deal with it constructively or do you deal with it in a negative way and turn to drugs and sex and about 1,000 other things? Just how you deal with your pain.
Do you agree with that?
I do. And I would say, frankly, that now, this could be debated for a long time, but I would say it's tougher to be a teenager now than it was before, and it's never been easy, and it's tougher to be a parent, too. There's this welter of challenges out there, and it ranges from the stuff that kids at age 11 or 12 can find on the Internet, the ways to purge to lose weight, the ways to take, and Ben is an expert in this, unfortunately, the ways to take over-the-counter medicines, he's taught me a lot about this, and cough syrups and so forth and get high on them. I mean, my friends and I had no idea of this stuff. You know, it was word of mouth, and we couldn't get on the Internet. And frankly, when my kids, who are young, watch television, when we're in a hotel on this book tour, I'm astounded by the garbage that's on in prime time, not on networks, but on cable. The sex and the violence and the MTV spring break with kids, you know, half naked, gyrating around each other. And I'm not a prude, I think, but I really think there's a sort of a cultural societal toxins out there, if you will, just the stuff that kids are exposed to. And it's hard to be a parent, and it's not a picnic to be a teenager.
We're talking about troubled teenagers and some of the solutions, the therapeutic boarding schools, some of the programs that are set up to help them. If you'd like to give us a call, the number is 1-800-989-8255. And we're going to go to Jan in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Charlotte. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I've had two children who've been in therapeutic boarding schools. One is currently still in a therapeutic boarding school, and I can't say enough positive things about them. We are an intact family. We do not drink. We do not do drugs. We do not do any of the things that you would sort of classify, quote, as bad parents. We're both professionals. We attended parenting classes. We tried to do everything right, and things still did not work out. And I guess as a parent, the way I could justify it in my mind was at least I knew that my kids were struggling and that I did what I needed to do to provide for them. And another way of looking at it for me was that, you know, when things go right, I can't take all the credit. And when things go wrong, I can't take all the blame. It's the hardest thing as a parent I've ever done. Mr. Mark has talked about how, you know, he had the perception that parents sent their children away to advocate for someone else to take or abdicate for someone else to take over the parenting. It's the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. But it's also the most rewarding thing to see your children come back and to have people who care for them and who are helping them get the skills that they were not able to get for whatever reason.
I'm curious, were you surprised when your second child also had to go to a therapeutic boarding school, or did they go at the same time?
No, my first child introduced my second child to drugs and to a deviant lifestyle. And so we thought we had been able to solve that problem and get the situation corrected, and it didn't work. Things fell apart even worse.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jan.
And I would say, just you know, to add to that, that's the kind of reaction that drove me to leave a job, a good job, and work for years on this book, because it's easy. If these are bad parents and the kids are bad seeds, you know, that you could just sort of dismiss it as this fluke. But again and again and again, I meet these parents who tried and something went awry, and it's frightening, it's harrowing, and it's worse because, I mean, I don't know her, but she sounds like she really did. She was trying to do the best for her kids. That's really scary to me.
Ben, did you feel like your parents had really tried?
They did, but my parents really had no clue what was going on. I mean, I was really shut in, and I just didn't tell anybody what was going on. And so I think they had a much harder time because they had to read into my mind, which is an almost impossible thing to do, to figure out what was going on with me.
Yeah. Do you have brothers or sisters?
I have two younger sisters.
And have you influenced them?
I think I have, and sometimes I fear for the worst, and sometimes I hope for the best.
You're not sure yet?
No, I mean, one's way too young to tell, but the other one, she's succeeding, she's doing very good, she's in high school, she's loving it.
Right. David, one other thing I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, we've heard two now so far from callers, very different reactions to this whole idea. One from a parent saying it was very successful. Earlier we heard from a woman who went, I'm not sure she went to a therapeutic boarding school, but certainly went to some kind of program. She had a drug problem and seemed to say that it made things worse and that she in fact found drugs there.
Right, and I would say, really, that's more of an indictment of our mental health system than it is of therapeutic schools, which are far from perfect, too. But what do you do when you have a kid who's really struggling with something, and a kid goes to a public high school where there's one guidance counselor for every 600 or 800 kids? What do you do when you're not really sure what's going on, when both, let's say it's a couple who are the parents, when both the husband and wife are working and commuting long hours and trying to get things going, and they just don't know who to turn to? You try to find a good child psychiatrist in most cities in this country, or a therapist who's really, really trained to deal with teenagers. It's tough. And so I'm certainly not saying that therapeutic boarding schools are the answer for everybody, but I think that the larger thing is that it's very hard to find good services, whether you have some money or especially whether you're working class, you have very limited or no health insurance. And so it's really a tragedy, and that, I think, is a larger story out there. There are kids, not the majority, but there are a lot of kids out there. Every high school I visit, kids come up to me afterwards and say, you know, I'm dealing with depression, or my parents broke up and I don't know what to do. And now, I'm not a therapist. I don't give them advice, but I just listen to them, and it's heartbreaking. I just got back from Ohio where kids approached me one after another to tell me, after I gave a speech, about the stuff that's going on in their neighborhoods or their homes. It's really, really frightening.
We should mention, too, that this particular school, and I don't know about all the programs, but this particular school is quite expensive.
So it costs, when Ben went through, it cost $70,000 for 14 months. I mean, I watched parents who refinanced their homes, who borrowed from grandparents and aunts and uncles, who scrimped and saved. And then sometimes if there's federal legislation that says that if your school district can't provide you appropriate services, it's kind of vague, for emotional and for physical handicaps, then the school board has to pay for you to go to some kind of program. And that happens with 10% of the kids who go to Swift River.
Ben, I just want to ask you one other question before you have to take off, and that is, what's your situation now? I know you said you had a relapse a little while ago, but are you in school? Are you heading towards college? What's going on?
I'm just taking some community college classes right now. I'm working my job. And actually, yesterday I was just finished and just need to mail out my college applications.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome.
Great. And David, if you can just stay for a little while longer, we are going to bring in another guest now. And to give us a better sense of the effectiveness of programs like Swift River, we're turning to Lawrence Steinberg. He's a professor of psychology at Temple University who studies problem behavior in adolescents. And he's also the author of the book, The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. He joins us by phone from his office in Philadelphia. Thanks for being with us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
Tell us, we haven't really talked about this yet, and that is there research on programs like Swift River and other programs that are geared towards helping out kids who are in trouble, like boot camps, that kind of thing?
There isn't a lot of research on programs like Swift River. There's more, I think, on programs that are specifically designed for kids who've been in trouble with the law. So there are residential treatment facilities for kids who've been adjudicated delinquent. And they've been studied somewhat. Certainly there is research on boot camps. Again, the kids that are studied typically are kids that are there because of criminal behavior, although the majority of them have the same kinds of problems that you've been discussing, because they have substance abuse problems, they suffer from depression, they have family problems, and the whole gamut.
We've been hearing about the fact that parents turn to a program like Swift River or maybe some of these other ones after they feel sort of desperate that they've exhausted all other options. Is there a way for a parent to know that that moment has come, that they've done all they can do?
Well, I think that if a parent is working with a good therapist, whether a psychologist, psychiatrist, counselor of some sort, who has experience in working with families, with teenagers, and that's critical. And I agree with a remark made before that there is a shortage of good people like that. But I think that this is probably a decision that's best made jointly between the family and the therapist who's been trying to work with them in the community, because it is a drastic step to send a child to a residential placement, and it is, as you just mentioned, a very, very extraordinarily expensive step. So it's not, I don't think it's a decision that parents alone should be making.
You know, I have to say, David has said that of the teenagers that he spent time with at Swift River, a large number of them, there were problems at home, there were dysfunctional families, but there were a certain number where there didn't seem to be any explanation for it. The parents seemed to be good parents, and they didn't really understand why things had gone awry. And it's almost like every parent's worst nightmare, that you're going to be the best parent in the world, and somehow at age 13 or 14, your child is going to get into this kind of serious problem.
Right. I think that if you looked at the histories of kids with these kinds of problems, that probably the one thing that most of them have in common would be some kind of family problem, either a stress on the family, marital conflict, just a bad parenting, ineffective monitoring, that sort of thing. But yes, there is a minority out there of kids where there isn't an easy explanation. It could be the accumulation of lots of small troublesome things that just tips a kid over the edge. So maybe a little bit of family conflict, association with a deviant peer group, and a terrible time in school, and together those things push the kid too far. Sometimes, frankly, and I hate to say it, it's bad luck. I mean, a lot of kids out there are experimenting with risky behaviors. Most of them come through adolescence fine, but some of them end up experimenting and end up getting dependent on drugs or alcohol, or end up committing a crime because of their experimentation, and then their whole life begins to unravel.
One other thing before we take another call, and that is some of these programs have themselves turned out to be very suspect. I think some of them have been shut down because of perhaps they've been abusive to the children, or really they didn't have particularly good accreditation in any way. How does a parent know what's a good program and what's not a good program?
Well, I think the first thing to say is that what we do know about these sorts of programs is that they are a mixed bag, and some of them are not good, and not all of them, even the good ones, don't work for all the kids who go to them. There isn't a one-size-fits-all here. But I think that if you're working with a therapist in your community who has experience dealing with a number of these programs, that therapist can probably be a better judge of whether the program is the right place for your kid than you as a parent who's completely ignorant about this can be.
Lauren Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University. He specializes in problem behavior in adolescents. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to Jennifer now. She's in Lake Tahoe, California. Hi, Jennifer.
Hello.
Go ahead.
I work for a wilderness therapy group home here, and the problems that I see with the program that we have and with other programs is that we are able to create an environment that families at home can almost never duplicate. So we find that our clients are very successful here, but when they go back home, they almost always fall back into using drugs and alcohol because they don't have the same sort of structure that we have here, and they also don't have the wilderness component that we have here. And I was just hoping that you could comment on that if you had any thoughts on that.
Let me ask you first, David Marcus, if you could tell me what happened with briefly, because we're going to have to take a break again in about a minute. What did the kids that you worked with, did they succeed after they left?
She makes a great point. In fact, I think sort of presciently picked a title for my epilogue, which just talks about how the real world is not like the bubble they lived in. And then I followed the kids. I wrote my epilogue, after the kids had been out for a year and a half. Most of them, including Ben, who you just heard, stumbled. They went back to drugs or drinking and so forth. I will say, though, that to my surprise, maybe, because I got to be really cynical and skeptical, they did have the tools to pick themselves up, just like I really believe in him, and I really believe these kids are doing great. I'm having a book launch in New York tomorrow and Thursday, and I've heard from kids all over the country who I knew at Swift River, who's gone through some tough times but are doing well now.
All right, we're going to finish up this conversation when we return from a short break. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're talking about families dealing with troubled teens. Our guests are Lauren Steinberg, a professor of psychology at Temple University and author of the book, The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. We're also joined by David Marcus, author of the book, What It Takes to Pull Me Through, which tells the story of four teens who attend a therapeutic facility in rural Massachusetts. Professor Steinberg, going back to the question we were dealing with just before the break, we heard a caller who works at a program out west say that part of the problem she sees is that the circumstances that occur in those programs that help these teenagers can't be duplicated when they get home, and so they regress.
Right, and I think that that's one of the problems and one of the reasons that very often the programs are not as effective as they might be. The most proven interventions that work with kids who have behavioral problems, conduct problems, substance abuse problems, are interventions that typically involve their family. Now, if a child is in a residential program and somehow there can be something done to help that child's family straighten things out at the same time, that's going to improve the chances of the child leaving the program and making the transition back home in a way that's not going to reverse whatever gains have been made while in the program. But I think that when parents send kids off far away from home, and then the kids come back, and if, as in most cases, some of the contributing factors were problems in the family environment, then having the kid come back to that same family environment may very well undo a lot of what's been done in the program.
Now, that was one thing, David Marcus, that at the program that you monitored or that you were watching for a number of years, they did try and get the parents pretty involved, even though the kids were far away from home.
Right. I mean, I'll say that I started this research before 9/11, and the group I was in straddled 9/11, so that what they found at this school, which is it's really pretty far removed in western Massachusetts, is that families from California, Arizona, big population areas where they're sort of these spread out suburbs, and frankly, kids do tend to get in a fair amount of trouble sometimes. They were reluctant after 9/11 to flying became more onerous and just cumbersome, and so they're not drawing for as much, I think, from the West as they used to, but because the parents have to come in for these family workshops and family therapy and so forth, and that's vital. That is crucial because you can't just take a kid as if he's some old Volvo and send him to a mechanic and say, you know, fix up the drive shaft and fix up a few things and send him back to us in a little while and we'll take him. You've got to work on the whole environment, the whole family, and sometimes you have to change schools. A lot of these kids went to public schools before, and they've changed into performing arts schools when they come back home for the last bit of schooling, high schooling, or they've gone to community colleges or so forth as Ben did. But it's very, very important that the toxic environment, whatever that environment is, whether it's family or school, is addressed too.
All right, let's try and see if we can get one more call in here. Fred in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Fred.
Yes, hi. I'm a clinical director for an outdoor-based program here in Arizona, and I just wanted to concur with what's being said. The aftercare component really is an essential aspect of the success of a program, whether they really do work closely with the parents and the whole family, maintain contact with the child, and help them make the transition back to their home. Because they can have a great experience in the wilderness and have a real, you know, awakening in their lives, but they do need some practical skills on how to apply that in the relationships at home with peers, all that sort of thing. And so the better programs, I think, parents really need to do a lot of research and find out what the philosophy is, what kind of clinical interventions they use, whether they're JCO accredited, those kinds of things to help them make the decision, because there really is a lot of variation in the philosophies and the curriculum and in programs, whether it's residential or outdoor-based.
All right, thanks, Fred. Mm-hmm. And let me ask both of you, we've been talking a lot about the programs themselves, but let's back up a little bit. I don't know if either of you, if there is one piece of advice or the best piece of advice you can think of to give parents that might help them prevent this from happening in the first place. Lawrence Steinberg?
Yeah. I guess I'm biased since I specialize in parenting and have a book out on good parenting. I mean, I think the best advice you could give parents is learn how to parent effectively. It is something that can be learned, and the earlier you start, the better your child's chances of coming through adolescence successfully are going to be. Having said that, it's also never too late to improve the quality of the home environment your child is growing up in. So I think from a research point of view, having a good, solid relationship with your child that's grounded in principles of good parenting is going to be the most important protective factor.
Can you sum up quickly principles of good parenting, or one or two?
Well, I think first of all, you need to be involved in your child's life, and that's more than having a 5-minute conversation at dinner every night. And the second is you need to provide structure and guidance and limits on your child's behavior, even as your child gets older and is pleading for more independence.
Thanks so much, Lawrence Steinberg. Lawrence Steinberg is a professor of psychology at Temple University and author of the book, The 10 Basic Principles of Good Parenting. He joined us by phone from his office in Philadelphia. Thanks for being with us.
Sure thing.
And David Marcus, if you could leave us with a few words, what did you glean from this in terms of how this problem might be avoided in the first place?
Well, I have to admit to you that I have realized that I'm not as good a parent as I should be. I try to be a friend to my kids, and I have to be much tougher and much stricter, not in a bad way, not spanking them, but by giving them clear rules and sticking with them. I'll say that two things I noticed that I think are very important, and I'm not a psychiatrist, but I'll just tell you what I noticed. One is that kids need an adult mentor. A lot of times when they're teenagers, frankly, they don't want to talk to their parents, but they're pining to talk to an adult. They want somebody just to listen to them. It might be an aunt and uncle. It might be a coach. It might be somebody who's just a friend of their parents, and that's really important. And the second thing is that these kids are incredibly, amazingly talented kids, and just because mom and dad figured they should be engineers or they should be something doesn't mean that's what they want to do. They need a passion. That passion might be music. It might be skateboarding, which parents hate, just going out and skateboarding. But they need a passion which is not sitting in front of a computer and playing games for 10 hours a day, but hopefully something involves the outdoors, or hopefully something involves something creative, drama, music, horseback riding, whatever it may be.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, David.
Thank you.
David Marcus is author of the book, What It Takes to Pull Me Through, Why Teenagers Get in Trouble and How 4 of Them Got Out. And he's a contributing editor to U.S. News and World Report. He joined us from member station WFCR in Amherst, Massachusetts.